I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. George Garrett joins me again, the award-winning journalist, Canadian biographer to a distinguished list of accomplishments and accolades. He is the author of The Life and Times of Lighthouse McNeil, An Adventure in the RCMP. It's a biography of Sterling McNeil, a remarkable figure whose distinguished career with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police brought credit to the force and the country. He also served with the RCAF during World War II and was the officer in charge of the RCMP musical ride. I'll ask George about the life of McNeil, why he was called Lighthouse, what endeared him to his family and friends, just how widely respected he was at home and abroad, and how George came to write this book. George Garrett is himself distinguished in this community for his nearly 50-year career in broadcast journalism. He has been twice honored by the BC Association of Broadcasters, as well as the recipient of Lifetime Achievement Awards from the BC Association of Broadcasters, the Radio and Television News Directors of Canada, and the Jack Webster Foundation, receiving the Bruce Hutchison Award. In 1993, he was named an honorary member of the RCMP Veterans Association, Vancouver branch, and made a life member in 2013. This new book is published by your Nichols Worth Publishing. You can order it, as I did, from the RCMP Heritage Center in Regina. Their website is at rcmpheritagecenter.com. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program in person today, George Garrett. Mr. Garrett, good morning.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
So I bought the book a couple of weeks ago, and while you were on vacation. Well, I guess you were on vacation / book tour for this,
yes,
right?
I was. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so where did you end up?
We started out by having a tour in Ottawa, and I went to the office of the Usher of the Black Rod, who happens to be a close personal friend of the son of the person I wrote about. Cam McNeil is the son's name. And they arranged for us, my cousin and his wife and I, to come to the Senate. We had parking right in front, quickly through the RCMP security checkpoint, up to see the Black Rod. And I offered to give him a book and said I would like to sign it. And he said, please have a seat at my chair, my desk. And I thought, I'm sitting at the desk of Black Rod? Come on. Anyway, I signed the book for him. And they gave us a tour of the Senate chamber. And then we went to the RCMP Musical Ride headquarters, mm-hmm, that evening. And we had a presentation of the book. What was really special for me is that Cam McNeil, the son, had been very helpful with me during the research of the book. He was there along with his wife, Aldine, and their family. He had a son and a daughter, their spouses, and the children. So I was talking to the whole family, really, and I knew there was a lot of pride in what I had been writing about, their grandfather, their father.
In reading the book, you just find out what a remarkable guy he was.
He was. He was an athlete. He was a pilot. He was a boxer. Above all, he was a man of integrity,
yeah,
and that showed throughout his life. He had a sense of humor, but he also had a great sense of devotion to duty, and that's what appealed to me. I've been very close to the RCMP for all my reporting life, you know, for over 40 years. Always had a high regard for them. I knew how many of them felt when the shocking incident happened at Vancouver Airport, the tasering of the Polish immigrant. And I thought a lot of mistakes were made then, and mistakes were made in a cover-up, which resulted in charges of perjury and one of the four officers now is serving a jail term. And I thought this was a low blow for a lot of the RCMP officers. It would be like being hit in the stomach. It's not something that they believe in. They believe in handling cases properly, treating people properly, and being fair, and getting the case before courts, if necessary, and giving truthful evidence. So that's my vision of the RCMP, and I have no reason to change it. From time to time, there are things that go wrong, and the YVR incident is one tragic example of that.
Would you just imagine if McNeil was around and running things, this would never have happened?
He would never have done that. For example, he had a situation where he was called in the middle of the night in one detachment where he was in, I believe it was Waskasoo, Saskatchewan, called in the middle of the night. There's a man with a hatchet chasing the cook around the kitchen. So he was roasted from his bed. He went there, grabbed the hatchet from the man, and put a police hold on him, took him to jail, and then went back to bed. And as it happened, that man was known as Gray Owl, who was a famous environmentalist, who was even honored by John Diefenbaker. who happened to like beavers. And on one occasion, after this incident of removing the hatchet from his hand, and he'd done that, by the way, he was waving the hatchet because he wanted breakfast at 2 or 3 in the morning and the cook wouldn't do it for him.
Yeah.
So anyway, after this incident of the hatchet, a few years went by, and the superintendent of parks in Los Casus said to McNeil, a police officer, "I want you to take some beaver food up to Gray Owl." And McNeil said, "That's not a job for the police, that's for the park wardens." And he said, "All my park wardens are out fighting forest fires, so would you please do it as a favor?" Well, yes. So McNeil and a special constable went by canoe and by boat, I guess, rather than a canoe, but they had a motor on it, which conked out. So they had to paddle, and they had to do a lot of portaging. And they finally got to Gray Owl's house, and he said, "Put the beaver food over there." McNeil said, "No, you will help us put it over there." And then when it came time to go to bed, Gray Owl said, "You and the other policemen can sleep outdoors." He said, "No, that's not the northern way. We're going into your house. The black flies and the mosquitoes out here are bad. We're going in your house." And what Gray Owl was concerned about was that he had a hole in the floor, and he had two pet beavers. One was Jelly Roll, and the other one was Rawhide. And he fed them inside his cabin. His concern was that the RCMP would disturb his beavers.
And later in life, they encounter each other once again, right?
Yes.
A book signing?
Yes, it's a book signing, and McNeil was in uniform, and Gray Owl looked and saw him, got up from what he was doing, signing books, and gave him a warm embrace and a very welcome hug. I guess there was some animosity, because when Gray Owl came from Great Britain, he'd been in World War I, he'd been injured, and he was on some kind of a pension. But his real name was Arthur Delaney, and he had to prove his identity to cash the checks that were coming from Britain. To do that, he had to go to the RCMP, in this case, McNeil.
Mm-hmm.
And McNeil knew his real name and knew that he was masquerading as Gray Owl. That really wasn't who he was. But McNeil felt, so each to his own system, his own way, that's fine with me.
Yeah. He was very tolerant. And you saw that in his relations with the First Nations as well as minorities.
He had great respect for the First Nations people, particularly the guides. He said that the RCMP could not have survived in the North without them. They taught them how to hunt, they taught them how to fish, they taught them how to survive in the very cold weather. On one occasion, he was chopping some wood, and his axe bounced off a frozen piece of wood and severely gashed his leg. And the native person with him bandaged up the leg and helped him to a great deal. And what happened one year was that McNeil, after retirement, was flying with his son to northern posts where he had been, and he was treated royally. He didn't really want that. He just wanted to meet the people.
Yeah.
And he found out about one native guide, an Inuit, who was in hospital. So he went to the hospital, and his wife is sitting at his bedside, and the man is on his deathbed. And McNeil said, "How are the RCMP? Are they looking after you?" And she said, "Oh, I've never heard from the RCMP for years."
Hmm.
And he was furious. His son said that he would never lost his temper, but if he did, look out. He went to the nearest detachment, barnstormed into the inspector's office, gave him a piece of his mind. That fellow died a couple of days later, and he had an honor guard from the RCMP.
Hmm.
And that was thanks to Mr. McNeil.
Yeah. And he had the foresight, too. I mean, you think of what he thought during the war with regards to interning the Japanese.
He did. He felt very, very strongly that Canada should not force the Japanese Canadians to go to the interior of BC as they did, or to Saskatchewan. One came right to my neighborhood, one family, so I got to know them. Mr. McNeil's position was that he was an intelligence officer in the Air Force. He'd been an RCMP officer. If anyone should know of any problems with the Japanese Canadians, he should, or his people that work for him. He said they are loyal Canadians, they are good citizens, we should not do this to them. But there was a mood at the time that was totally opposite that and resulted in probably one of the worst things the Canadian government has ever done to its own people.
And so he served in the Air Force during the Second World War. Where was he stationed?
He was stationed in Calgary, and then he became responsible for all the intelligence on the West Coast, including along the BC coast here. And he went through the ranks very quickly, started as a pilot officer, as they all do, then flying officer, then squadron leader, and then wing commander, which is the equivalent to today's colonel. And he was had a chauffeur, had his own limousine, he had everything.
Yeah.
And he was responsible for a lot, but... So a high office, and he carried it out well.
You mentioned earlier his time in the North, and you write in the book about just how special the special connection between the RCMP and the North.
Relied on the RCMP. They did everything from assist with births, believe it or not, to issuing stamps for beaver licenses and so on. They had a lot to do with the coroner's service. There was none. They did all that function. They did just about everything. If something broke, like an article, they would bring it to the police to help them fix it and so on. So they were such an integral part of the community. And Mr. McNeil's case, he had a very, very strong feeling, a feeling of bonding with the people of the North, no matter whether they were indigenous or non-indigenous.
Why was he called Lighthouse?
Because he was very tall.
How tall was he?
6'4".
Wow.
Among other things, he was a professional football player. He got into the RCMP because he was playing baseball with some RCMP guys in the summertime in Lethbridge, Alberta. And a sergeant major there, or staff sergeant, excuse me, said, would you like to join the RCMP? We're taking on some people. And he thought, well, it would be 3 square meals a day and maybe some money in my pocket at the end of the month. So he thought, I'll try to join. And he had to have references, you know, from prominent people in the community. He had those. But when he got to the doctor said, you're 176 and a half pounds. And the limit, because of the horses, is 175 pounds. So you're 1.5 overweight. Can't accept you. So McNeil said, could you give me the weekend? Let's try and lose some weight. So he borrowed a rubber suit, which was owned by a punch-drunk former boxer who once sparred with Jack Dempsey. His name was Lee Tesler. And he said, I'd like to borrow your rubber suit. And this fellow said, sure, Mac, go ahead. So he said he cleaned it out, put it on, and he ran the whole weekend in Lethbridge. And he took laxatives and made sure he didn't eat anymore. And lo and behold, on Monday morning, he weighed in and he beat the 175 deadline. And he said, the first thing I did was go have a big breakfast. I was hungry.
There's a funny line in the book about how, I guess he was in the RCMP, 35 years or so?
Yes.
Yeah, and then he was in retirement about 35 years.
Yes.
And he probably made more financially on his pension than he did in salary.
Yes, it was a Toronto writer who wrote about that, saying that it appealed to the parsimonious Scott that he'd been able to get more money after retiring than he had during his career. And I kind of deflected my thought about why he was called Lighthouse.
Yeah.
In addition to baseball, he played football.
Yeah.
So good that the Saskatchewan Roughriders wanted him while he was a Mountie. So the RCMP made the Rough Riders sign a waiver. In essence, it said, if you break him, you've got to fix him, because he's ours.
Yeah.
So we played a few games, and in one game, he was a receiver, and he was in the clear, and the quarterback had not thrown him the ball. So he went back to the huddle, and he said, why didn't you throw me the ball? I'm so tall, I'm like a ruddy lighthouse out there. And the name stuck.
Yeah.
And he did play again for the Saskatchewan Rough Riders, but one game that he missed was for a very good reason. He was called to a coal miner's strike, which developed into a riot in Estevan, Saskatchewan, which is southeast of Regina. And it was one thing in Canadian history that I had not known about. And my editor, Heather Nickel, did a wonderful job of researching that factor.
Yeah.
And no wonder there was a strike. This was in 1931. Here are miners who are working underground, You can hardly stand up because it's not high enough. They're working in water sometimes. They're paid 25 cents a ton for coal. And if there's any material within the coal that is not proper, they're deducted for that.
Yeah.
And they're not paid for building timbers to shore up the mine, not paid for a number of other things, only for the coal that they dig. So, and even at that time, at 25 cents a ton, the owners in the Saskatchewan mine were about to reduce their payment because of the recession going on. So that's what resulted in a riot. And one incident within the riot was that McNeil was there. They pulled out the fire engine out of the fire hall, hooked up the hoses with the idea of using the water, high pressure, to dispel the rioters. Yeah. Well, they got the fire truck out of the hall, and the rioters had axes, and they chopped the hoses so they couldn't use the hoses. Another rioter jumped up onto the fire truck, happened to be a brand new one, and the windshield was down, but he was poised with an axe about to smash the windshield when he was shot right in the chest, and he fell at McNeil's feet. And McNeil said, "I had no training in first aid, but I knew that he was dead, so I just covered his face. And that's all I could do."
Yeah.
Subsequently, one of the other officers was warding off the blows from the rioters with his riding crop, which is not much of a defensive weapon.
Yeah.
His arm was broken. So McNeil got him to a shelter, and he put a lanyard around his arm to hold it, put a gun on the table, and he said, "I'm locking the door. If anyone comes through that door, you know what to do."
Yeah.
Implying, I guess, that shoot him.
Yeah.
However, the RCMP were not known for ever using weapons. But in that case, the inspector in charge ordered his men to fire into the air to dispel the rioters, which surprised a lot of people.
Yeah.
And one more thing on the riot. McNeil said he was taking someone to hospital, and he was flagged down and told that someone's been injured. It was a woman. She was a visiting teacher, and she'd been looking out the window, and a bullet had ricocheted off a wall and hit her in her ample bosom, and she was bleeding profusely. So McNeil and others bandaged up the wound as best they could, and he carried her to a waiting vehicle, took her to the hospital, and he told them that, you know, she needed immediate attention because of the bleeding. And because he was holding her and her breast was bleeding, it got on his jacket. And he said, "I could never get the stain out of that jacket." And it really bothered him because he knew that it meant that this woman had been injured.
Yeah. There's a lot of stories in this book about just how he viewed his job. It was service. It wasn't,
oh, yes, service to the community.
Yeah, and he would, even when he was off duty, he would have his book with him in case he needed to write people up on tickets.
And his family said he'd give a ticket to his own grandmother. But he did carry it with him, and if he saw someone violating a traffic rule, the family said the wheels would spin, the gravel would fly, and he'd go after them. But in the community, for instance, in the town of Bigger, Saskatchewan, where I know, I've been there, he was a sergeant there. He decided that some of the kids in town were not behaving properly, so he put them to work digging a swimming pool. He said, "This community needs a swimming pool." And sometimes he'd go through the beer parlors and clear them out. "Come on, boys, we're going to work." And they dug the swimming pool, and it was a success.
Yeah.
And one occasion, apparently a couple of the guys were paid for doing it. And he said, "Let's see the money, boys. We'll put that in the fund for the pool."
Yeah.
That was the way he was. It was the community first.
Yeah. When did he meet Carolyn?
1940 was their marriage, but before that, when he was in Lethbridge, 1931, just before he joined, he met this lovely young girl named Carrie Stauffer. Full name was Carolyn. And he thought she was pretty good. And he never met her again until a few years later. He had been flown into Edmonton by a friend in a private plane. And by the travel regulations in the RCMP, where you had to wear your red serge when you traveled, and he hated that. So he couldn't wait to get changed. So he's rushing through to the McDonald Hotel in Edmonton, and he called it a whirling door, meaning a revolving door.
Yeah.
He went through that so fast, he knocked down this lady, which happened to be Carolyn. And he said, oh, I know. He said, you're Carrie Stauffer. She said, oh, yes, I remember you from Lethbridge. And she had had several proposals for marriage, but her father had been an RCMP officer, and he was very, very strict, and there had to be the right person. Turns out Sterling McNeil was that person. And they were about to be married when the war broke out, and he was automatically seconded to the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
The whole air division of the RCMP was taken over by the Air Force, RCAF, much to the chagrin of the commissioner at the time. So he became an Air Force officer. He'd already had permission from the RCMP to get married, which was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for one thing, you had to have 5 years' service. You had to have $500 at that time in the bank. So he had permission from the RCMP, but because he went in the Air Force, he had to get approval all over again. And as it turns out, when he finally got approval, he was in Quebec. His bride-to-be is out here in the West, and they were going to be married in Toronto. So he wrote two letters, one to his wife. He said, my brother will meet you in the train station in Toronto. Just look for the handsomest man in the terminal. He wrote to his brother, and he said, Carrie is coming from the West Coast, and she's a beautiful woman. Just look for the most beautiful woman in the terminal. That'll be Carrie. And as coincidence would have it, they came almost face to face.
Really?
Recognized each other immediately, although they'd never met.
Yeah.
And he turned out to be the best man at the wedding.
And by all accounts, a happy...
Oh, a very, very...
Marriage, right?
A wonderful marriage. Two children, Cameron, Cam, the one that I spoke to a lot, and his sister... who lives in the Langley area, named Barbara, and she's married to a former RCMP officer who is now a well-known lawyer in Langley. So the connections are all there.
Yeah. Later on, they end up in Prince Edward Island.
Yes.
That was, I guess, his last posting before retirement.
Yes.
And she became well-known in the community.
She did, and they handled some royal visits, one of them being in Prince Edward Island. She was a professional florist by trade, and she knew how to entertain quite regally. And the government house in Charlottetown was not in very good condition for the royal visit, but she was one of those who helped to make sure that it was brought up to standard.
Yeah.
And she hosted the Queen, and I guess it was...
The hostess with the mostess was the one person
one of the
described
quotes
her.
From,
yeah.
My wife and I went over to Victoria to interview Mrs. Farr, the widow of a former assistant commissioner,
uh-huh.
who was a friend of McNeil's, and she said she, the hostess with the mostess, really.
Yeah.
She set a beautiful table, and she was a very gracious person, and met people warmly. So she was successful. And she was surprised one time in Prince Edward Island when the premier came to call. And she said to her husband, isn't that something, or she said to her daughter, isn't that something, the premier's come to call and we couldn't even be on the voters list, we haven't been here that long. And so they didn't hear the conversation. They didn't find out till years later. The premier had come to visit the superintendent of the RCMP, McNeil, to ask if he would relax the liquor laws the next day because it was
election day. Yeah.
And McNeil was a man of stick to the rules. And he said, I'm responsible for the enforcement of the Liquor Act in Prince Edward Island, and that act will be enforced. Thank you for coming, sir. Good night. And that was it.
And the guy lost, too, right?
He lost the election the next day.
Yeah. So what was there was a story in the book, and I can't remember now the details, but someone had asked him for a favor. And he said, put it in writing.
Yes, right. It was someone who was, he said, you are my superior.
Yeah.
And you're a civilian.
Yeah.
And he said, if you would like me to do this, if you'll put it in writing, I will make sure it's attended to. Well, everybody knows you don't want a paper trail, even in the 1940s, 50s, I guess it was then.
Yeah, just incorruptible.
Yes, he was. His daughter said there was no getting around it. You stuck by the rules with him. He did have an incident where one of his members arrested a prominent citizen for impaired driving,
mm-hmm.
Put him in jail. And I guess he was shaking in his boots, so he contacted his superintendent, and he said, "Sir, what'll I do? I've arrested so-and-so, and he's in jail." And so the superintendent said, "Well, he's in the clink." I said, "Right, sir, he is." He said, "Just leave him there till his lawyer comes, and that's fine. Carry on."
Yeah.
In other words, you've done your job. You've done it the right way.
Yeah.
And later on, that person, although he was angry at the time, appreciated that he had been dealt with respect.
Yeah.
And that he wasn't given any favorable consideration, nor was he entitled to it. And he respected that.
Back to the money for just a sec, because I just remembered you write in the book that upon his retirement, he was offered the lieutenant governor's position.
Yes,
there.
He
decided not to take it.
Yes, he was offered that. He was offered two things. One was a man of the year in Prince Edward Island. And as you know, in Prince Edward Island, there's a very close feeling about local people. Anyone else is from away.
Yeah.
And they have to earn their way into the community. Well, he certainly did. He was very well regarded there. First, he was offered Citizen of the Year or something like that, and he said, "No, you should give that to someone who was born in Prince Edward Island." And as he was winding up his career, he was offered the position of Lieutenant Governor. And he said, "My pension, my resources, I can't afford to do that." So he turned it down.
Yeah. And then he moves out here?
He moved to Brentwood Bay on Vancouver Island. It was the first time he'd ever owned a house. In those days, the accommodation was provided. And that was kind of a double-edged sword, because those members who lived in government accommodation didn't have to worry about paying a mortgage at the time, but they didn't acquire any equity in a home.
Mm-hmm.
So when they retired, it was quite a challenge to buy a home.
Yeah.
He did so, he and his wife Carolyn, on Vancouver Island, Brentwood Bay. They loved it over there, and they quickly became involved in the community. He was involved in every organization having to do with retired policemen, retired Air Force officers, even an organization called RUSI, which was a combination of military officers, mostly military, and some RCMP. I think they called McNeil our Mountie. And he was also involved in many community activities, as he had been in Prince Edward Island.
Yeah.
And every other community he'd been in. And he became engrossed in helping whatever he could. So
yeah.
He had an active retirement until his ill health forced him to come to live with his son, his daughter and her husband in Langley. He and his wife came over.
Yeah.
And I talked to the family, of course, and they had built a basement suite for them in the home in Langley. But he increasingly had problems with his legs, particularly. He had circulation problems, and it was so bad that they had to do amputations. It came to the point where he had nothing left of his body but his torso. And his daughter described how her poor father, helpless as a torso lying on a hospital bed, his hearing had gone, he could hardly see, but yet his mind was still good. And he never complained. And she said, "I could see sometime the excruciating pain."
Just even touching the
yes,
nerve endings, yeah.
And the nerve endings, and but he would try to stifle the crying out, but it hurt so much. And the one person who I think best described him, what kind of a man he was the Reverend Pam Worthington, the minister he met. And there's a quote there on the back of the book that I'd like to refer to that says a lot about him and about her respect for him. She said he would come to church in his wheelchair. He'd have his medals on and wearing his blazer.
Yeah.
And I guess the tam, you know, the beret. And he looked very proud. She said, even sitting in his wheelchair, he looked proud.
Straight up.
Straight up.
Yeah.
And very proud of his service in the RCMP. And I recorded everything that every one of my people that I've contacted
did.
I recorded their interviews and transcribed them verbatim.
Yeah.
And then back to the notes to make sure they were correct. And this is the quote from Pam Worthington, a minister in the church in Fort Langley. "As we journey through life, we encounter, if we're lucky, that rare person whose life touches us with pure gold. We're enriched by that encounter. We're blessed, and we're better than we were before. Sterling McNeil was that kind of person.
Yeah. That sums it up, but doesn't
it? It does.
Yeah.
It says a lot about his life, his quality of character, his devotion to duty. And those were the things within the RCMP that I thought the public would like to know about. I happen to believe that there's a great deal of respect for the RCMP across the country, despite sometimes the mistakes that are made. And in this day and age, they're magnified by the social media, for one, and by the general media, and justifiably so. If they made a mistake, they should be called to account. But there's that underlying quality of the RCMP, which begins in training with the selection of personnel, and it carries through. And I've known so many members, mostly men, because of my age, but of course the women were brought along.
I read in the book that women weren't allowed until to join the force until the mid-70s, was it?
Yeah, I think it was 72 or 73, somewhere in that area, and they've done very well. Now, even Bev Buff, what's her name now? Bev Busson actually became the commissioner.
Yeah,
I knew her here in British Columbia. She was the assistant commissioner and then a high rank higher, a deputy commissioner in charge of the whole E Division. And I had coffee with her and a number of other people one day in their headquarters on Heather Street, as there where it was then. And I said, "You were commissioned in Saskatchewan, weren't you?" And I said, she said, "Yes, I was." And you were the first officer in North Battleford, which was where I started in radio.
Yeah.
She said, "Yes, I was in North Battleford." And she said, from there I was transferred to British Columbia. She said, I have a habit of pretty heavy foot when I'm driving my Camaro. And she said, I had a highway patrol guy pull me over. And she said, because I was being transferred, my uniforms were in the car, and her rank was showing on the shoulder epaulet. And as the officer approached the car, he looked and saw the uniform, and he said, "Oh, you were that woman."
Say, George, in the course of your research and in your writing this book, because he's such a remarkable guy, did you find anything bad about him?
I didn't. I went to one publisher, in fact, this fellow from Victoria, who met me for coffee in Vancouver, and he'd read a couple of chapters, and he said, "I don't find anything in there that's negative." I said, "No, there isn't." He said, "I don't see any controversy." I said, "No, there isn't." Well, he said, "It can't be much of a book if we don't have any controversy." So I called my advisor, who is Superintendent Ernie McCauley, now lives in Prince Edward Island. He used to be the officer in charge in Richmond.
Yeah.
He gave me a lot of advice. And I said, "Ernie, I've been told by a publisher that there should be some controversy in the book, and if there's not, in effect, if there isn't some, I should make it up." He said, "George, that's not you. That's not McNeil."
Yeah.
So I ignored that advice from the publisher. And a friend of mine who really pushed this is a fellow named Ron Budd, retired sergeant. He persisted with the RCMP Heritage Center in Regina.
Yeah.
About three emails, I think, before he connected with the president, Al Nicholson. And he said, "You've got to publish this book because it's important to the RCMP. And McCauley, my advisor, said, "This book should be read by every recruit in the RCMP because it talks about standards, it talks about integrity, about quality, and the things that the RCMP stand for." And what I found out, by the way, when I went to Regina recently, is that it's pretty difficult to recruit young people into the RCMP now. The average age of a recruit, which really surprised me, is now 29.
Hmm.
So I said to the chief superintendent who gave me that information, that I said, it must be difficult physically for a person 35 years old to take the training. And he said, "Yes, some of them can't do it. They try, but they can't." So it's changing quite a bit. Of course, there are a lot more women in the RCMP now.
Yeah.
I was in the mess hall. I had my lunch, and I sat down with a group of young officers. And what I didn't realize, that most of them were female, but they were all French-Canadian, and they were all speaking French. So I had no opportunity to converse with them.
Yeah.
I don't have French.
What does the family think of this book? I mean, I guess you alluded to it earlier that they're quite proud of their father, their grandfather. But I mean, now that the book's out, that must be just great for them to, the people will get to know the, this
relative. I think so. I think they're quite pleased with it. You know, it's not the kind of thing that my grandchildren would particularly be interested in terms of history of the forest, but I think they're all pretty intelligent young people in their 20s. I think they would recognize the values of devotion to duty and integrity and that kind of thing. So I think, in a way, there's a message there that I think they'll pick up on.
George, we the last time you were on the show, we talked about your career in the media.
Yes.
And you mentioned off the top about just the relationships that you've developed over the years, especially with law enforcement and how important they were. Did you get any criticism throughout your during your career about, say, being too close to the police?
Oh, yes, I did, particularly from a former producer at CTV. It's a woman whom I think I helped a little bit. I gave her a pretty good recommendation. And we were at a social function out for dinner after covering a trial on Vancouver Island. And she really cut me to the quick. She said, "I guess you're kind of a cop suck, aren't you?" And I said, "What?" And I always found that if I had to do a story about a bad cop, I got cooperation on that more than any other story, because the good cops, which is 99%, didn't like to have a bad cop. And one I recall is there was a staff sergeant in charge of the RCMP drugs, and I got a tip about two members in Richmond involved in cocaine, arrested and charged. And you would think, you know, if you call the RCMP, they're going to say, "Oh, no comment."
Yeah.
No. I called this fellow, a staff sergeant, Smokey Stover, is his name. And I said, "Smokey, it's George calling." I said, "You got a couple of bad ones?" He said, "Yeah, you want their names?" And I said, "Yes, please." He gave me the names right away.
Yeah.
And no hesitation whatsoever. So I think policemen have understood that you're going to do a story about a negative thing with them, and if they deserve it, go to it.
Yeah. Well, you've done a great service telling us about Lighthouse McNeil. Just a fascinating, remarkable person that everyone needs to know about. You know, I mean, it harkens back to a different era, but just the qualities of this person that I guess we all need. We need in our police force nowadays, so congratulations on this, and you know, I just remembered when you were on nearly 2 years ago now, the first time you were on, at the end of our chat, I misspoke and said that I had admired you as a writer, but I guess now it sticks, doesn't it, because you've got a book
well,
now.
Well, I never considered myself a writer, excuse me, but I'm a storyteller, and I think the stories are in there.
Yeah. Nice to see you again.
Thank you very much.
And good luck with the book.
Thank you. Sorry for my voice going.
The Life and Times of Lighthouse McNeil, an Adventure in the RCMP. It's published by your Nicholsworth Publishing. It's author George Garrett. Join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.